and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. My name's Alex. I'm joined, as always, by Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Alex. Welcome back to the world of podcasting.
Good to be here. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good. Good. The sun is shining, as always, in the world of the Atlas Podcast, so we're all good to go here.
Even on grey days, we are indeed. So this week we're looking at the James Webb Telescope for our new spot. We're also going to be talking about IT-OT convergence. And then finally, we're joined by Ella Podmore of McLaren. She is materials engineer for McLaren. For a very interesting
interview that is. So definitely stick around for that. If the other articles are interesting as well, aren't they? I mean, James Webb was in the news a little while ago, wasn't it? And now it's starting to come back into the news, so we thought we'd catch up with that.
Yeah, it's just after being launched last year, it's just getting towards a sort of readiness level, isn't it? I think next month is when we're getting the first official bits and pieces of what they've been doing with it. But I guess the first year is just calibration, etc., that sort of thing.
Yeah, so we're diving straight into it. We'll dive straight into the news. So I was listening to a few things because it had fallen out of my memory a little bit about the James Webb Space Telescope. It was great seeing the launch, and I was following the tracker as it was making its maneuvers through space and trying out all of its different systems. It was a much delayed launch because of the amount of single point of failures that this space telescope has, and the processes and procedures of unfurling its heat shields and all of this type of thing. And then it got into position, and now it's circling nicely in far out of space, but definitely in a location further than we can maintain it or support it, a bit like the Hubble. It's close enough to be able to make those crucial changes to make Hubble as the success it has been. And I think the one thing to point out during that launch was the expected lifetime of the James Webb Telescope, due to its battery power and the amount of power it takes to get it to its Lagrange point where it's circulating, was only around about 5 years. So it's expected to do 5 years of experiments. But because of the efficiency of the launch, I think it was managed by the European Space Agency, because of the efficiency of the calculations around it and the launch, they're actually projecting or expecting it to last for four times that length now. So up to 20 years, which is incredible, really. Something designed and obviously delayed in this process, but actually we've squeezed out an extra 15 years of experimentation just because of the efficiency of the launch and the amount of power that we've managed to maintain within the systems, which is an incredible start, really.
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually, and I wasn't sure what the answer is. You've answered it a little bit there, but obviously Hubble is just over 30 years old now. 1991 was when it launched. And I did notice there was a shorter operating window for the James Webb Telescope. Yeah. And I wasn't sure whether that was also something to do with perhaps prospected wear and tear, because as we saw as well in the news, it has just been hit by a little pebble from somewhere, which has damaged one of these big yellow refractors that it has on it. And obviously the design is very different to the Hubble, where the Hubble is in its own sort of casing, its own body, whether the fact that the James Webb Telescope is much more open and actually what it's guarded from mainly is heat from the sun and rays from the sun rather than debris, whether that operating window they put on it is just a sort of, we think it'll last this long before it's too damaged to continue, or as you're saying, is it about the energy that it has to run on?
And yeah, that was the that was the other interesting dynamic of the couple of news stories we saw this week, or over the last couple of weeks, was that this isn't space junk as much. I think Hubble's main issue, because it is in a different orbit, is really around tracking a space junk. And there's some a big problem is the amount of space junk we have up there, and those tiny fragments, you could say, are human generated junk in space. That there are millions of them, and they are all tracked as much as we know, because they can cause so much chaos. But this, with the James Webb being so far out, that it's not so much prone to that kind of junk, but just the bits and bobs and dust and stuff that's floating around in general space. So it looks like it's taken a little bit of a hit. So yeah, we're talking about the energy efficiency of the takeoff when it's got 20 years, but there's no prediction of the of events that are beyond our knowledge. So yeah, that includes those kind of small particles hitting such delicate structures. So thankfully,
yes, it looks like
it all survived, but that's good.
Yeah, there's a small amount of damage, which they, from what I've read, they just sort of adjust the movement or the position of these things around, so it won't be able to produce exactly the clarity, but they can compensate for it by just shifting things slightly by remote, I guess. These are all independently controllable units, I guess.
Yeah, and that's those kind of mirrors that are focusing the particles of light, or whatever we want to call them, that are coming from deep space. And they've got those kind of four instruments rigged up on the James Webb telescope to be able to maximize that information. And that's really the phase it's going through at the moment, which is this commissioning phase. It hasn't actually started into an operational phase. And you're thinking, there's a couple of things to think about there. Commissioning, how do you commission it? Well, that was the other news article about the results already coming through, and you can see the pictures between the difference between the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is the infrared array, and the James Webb Telescope in its calibration phase, and the images are remarably different. You know,
incredibly clear.
Like,
yeah.
And this is whilst we're still calibrating the instrumentation. So there's been a great progress in the fact that the calibration sequences are showing some great results, and then a bit of negative there with the impact and the damage that's caused. So it just shows you the fragility of the situation that the telescope is in, really.
Yes.
But so far, so good. And the damage looks like, as you said, we can adjust our way out of it, either through some kind of hardware means or software means. Which is great, really.
No, it's incredible. And yeah, I mean, it's the setup of it. So it's got these four different instruments, four main instruments: the mid-infrared instrument, near-infrared camera, near-infrared spectrograph, and the near-infrared imager, and slitless spectrograph / fine guidance sensor, none of which I understand. I mean, I get a bit of it for sure. So it's picking up infrareds, a lot of infrareds, and I think that's one of the reasons it operates at such a low temperature, isn't it? That's why it's not in a housing, because it needs to be about the temperature of the void of space so that it can pick up these infrared rays more clearly than something like the Hubble could do.
Yeah, so the Hubble works in a different part of the spectrum. So also, as I said, the Spitzer telescope. And one thing I found interesting in an article I read recently is that the Hubble's not being decommissioned, and the Webb isn't a replacement necessarily for the Hubble, because the Hubble works at a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's actually going to work in coordination with the James Webb, because basically, in inverted commas, it can see stuff that the James Webb can't see, but the James Webb can see things in far more definition and clarity within that mid-infrared spectrum, which in effect is what we perceive with our human instrument as heat. You could school, we're trying to keep it as cool as possible, so you get that a bigger differential between the heat that we're receiving in the form of infrared spectrum and the outside environment. Otherwise it would just be drowned out by the noise. Well, if it's exposed to the sun or the earth, it would fry the instrumentation anyway with the amount of.
Mm.
So yeah, some great stuff there, and great use of seeing, great to know that Hubble's also going to be a part of this. And the operational phase, I think, is fascinating, because if you think 5 years worth of planned experimentation using these different instruments, that means there's loads of different scientists out there all trying to get a slice of the time, all trying to schedule their time of being able to utilize the James Webb telescope. And I'm sure there will still be a rush to see who's going to be first to use it, and I'm sure that's already planned out and approached. But given the fact, by rights, given the fact that if there's no damage, that could extend out to 20 years, that really does mean that they're going to be, you know, four times the amount of science being produced. And I think there's also already, as there would be with all these things, the replacement for James Webb being designed.
Of course, and I'm sure there's people thinking about the replacement for the replacement as well.
Exactly. So yeah, great to see it coming into life, and really excited to see what they find with it, because one of our favourite planets is going to be on its list of things to look at, and that's the gas giant Uranus. There's 101 jokes in that.
No, of course, which we have all written down, ready to go. Yeah, and I am happy to be back talking about space. I did think today before the episode started recording, we've managed to go 3 episodes without talking about space in this new series, which just seems crazy. It's our favourite topic, but yeah.
Yeah, and we do avoid biology generally, because that's really difficult stuff. But yeah, it's great. Yeah, so few news items appearing, and we can't wait for the first results.
Yeah, we'll probably be back talking about James Webb next month as they enter this operational phase. Yeah. Alrighty, on to our tech spot for the week. It's something that comes up in our work life often, something we talk about and write about a lot, and it's IT-OT convergence. So to introduce the idea, I think everybody knows what IT is. However tech-minded you are, even me, with my writer's brain, knew what IT was before I started in the industry. OT, I think, is less well known, and it's quite specific to industry. And it's obviously IT, information technology, versus OT, operational technology. So where IT is systems that deal with data, OT are digital, either software or hardware, systems that deal with the real world. So monitoring, changing processes, and having an effect on the real world. So when we talk about IT-OT convergence, it's this thing that started to happen probably a few decades ago, but is still happening today, is those two worlds crossing over and meeting each other, and yeah, how that can help us and what the challenges are in there.
Yeah, and it's such a big subject that we haven't really come up with the answer, but we'll discuss a little bit around it. You did a great job of explaining those two worlds. I thought the interesting thing the other day when we talked about 5G, there's obviously other worlds as well, which is the telco industry, which hasn't necessarily fitted into the IT industry before. And with 5G, that was a part of that discussion. Why now is the telco moving into IT, or is the IT moving into telco? And it's a bit like this with the IT-OT convergence, because I guess the word convergence is probably the controversial word out of that statement, because defining what IT is and defining what OT is easier than defining how do you converge those two worlds together. And so, yeah, the reason for that and why it's difficult is because of people and structures. So much about digital transformation is about the processes we put in place, the structures that facilitate those processes, the people involved, and the fourth point is the technology and how that technology is adopted. So without having those kind of first three elements, we can talk about technology in isolation, but we can't really talk about convergence without talking about process, structure, and people. And that's the reality of it. So let's dive down into the OT world a little bit. And the world that I'm very familiar with in my past, if you like, and why I could never quite understand why people were so turned on by IT, because the beauty of OT, the beauty of OT world is whatever you're programming, as you rightly said there, Alex, it's a part of the physical world. So you see a physical effect often, or you're receiving a physical effect. You're actually, you're more in the system thinking world, or whether that's closed or open loop. You're sensing the world, you're making some kind of logical decision, and you're outputting to the world to affect the world based on its input, which requires something physical in the end of it. And when you look at the IT world, you know, the classical email system, it's like, what's the point in that type of thing? It was very much always my approach that there's so much fun in engineering and seeing everything from complete factories to gas turbines to nuclear reactors all being controlled by your operational technologies, and seeing that physical effect that has compared to your IT world, which is all about data and databases, but which is one of the reasons I think there is this convergence problem, because the main players involved in the OT and the IT world are different people.
Yeah.
With different processes and different structures. So in the OT world, you kind of get your technicians, your operators, your engineers, those type of people that are really interested in how things work and how you keep them working. So they kind of have their priorities are different to that of the IT world, where really they're looking at the uptime and availability of equipment. There, and we've written a few articles about this in the past, about the different business improvement activities, things like Lean, Six Sigma, that demand us to drive down what we're doing within the operational technology to zero defects. And that's really what the, you know, term Six Sigma is about. But we're also interested in safety systems, because robots are very powerful things, and therefore keeping a robot at arm's length or any type of mechanical machinery requires a lot of safety systems built around it to ensure that people can't come into interaction, or if they do come into interaction, they're doing it in a safe way. So all of these stuff don't, you know, if you talked in these terms in the IT world, how would you talk about email safety in those kind of ways? You know, it's a different mindset, and it's a different approach to it. So you have operational technologies, you have them interacting with the physical world, you've got to make sure that those physical world are safe, but you've got to be able to solve problems with the types of technology that we have within it. And those types of things involved in that, and we talked about them before, are things like programmable logic controllers. More and more we're talking about the world of IoT, Industrial Internet of Things, or the Industrial Internet of Things, and how we can hook up things like sensors, actuators, monitor all those systems, and work with a whole load of legacy systems. So the operational world does tend to have a lot of legacy applications, because this is another big difference between the IT and OT world, is that they haven't been necessarily born on a Windows platform. So how do you plug something into an IT network when it doesn't know necessarily how to talk in an IT language? Over the years, those systems have been plugged into things, but they, you know, through Ethernet and now into IoT, but the IT system don't know how to deal with them. They don't know how to deal with the patch management of them, the security updates, you know, all those things it wants to do to your laptop, it doesn't know how to do to a PLC or a application that was built on a Windows 3.1 environment, you know, or a Linux-based solution. So, yeah, there's a whole load of reasons there why the IT world doesn't really understand the OT world. So,
yeah,
what's the IT world? Well, IT world is your, is your traditional IT manager, your computer scientist, your chief information officer, your graduates and things like that. So a whole different type of people. So asking that type of people to go and then go and work in an engineering environment, they don't have the skill set or the knowledge.
Worlds apart, yeah.
Yeah. And in some regards, they try and keep it, they call it a DMZ, a demilitarized zone, around the IT system. So it can't, from a security point of view, can't get any threats coming into it. And one of those big threats it sees is the OT world, the operational technology world, with all these different systems that go within it. And we haven't even started to talk about integration at this point, because the integration systems and approaches in the IT world are completely different to the integration technologies in the OT world. So IT is moving on to API integration, where OT lives in the world of OPC and OPC UA and things like this, and control networks, including profit bus and control net, all these different networkings that may bridge onto an Ethernet platform. But then the IT kind of go, hold on, I don't know what this thing is. I don't know how to interpret this network. You know, so how do you control your firewall rules when you don't even know what this thing is? So that's the story behind it, Alex.
Yeah.
If you could,
well, I was going to ask then. Yeah, if it's obviously we're talking about, or we were setting it up as convergence. What is the convergence? What is the route to that? Because I mean, you've given, there are lots of good reasons why convergence is difficult and why those two worlds live separately. I think in going back to the 5G and telecoms chat we have, I remember one thing that came up was there's a sort of period 3G, 4G, where phones began to do computer things and computers began to do phone things. And now we have 5G devices are basically computer phone things. So there is that convergence, and it's about creating that technology that sits in both areas. Is that similar to this discussion, that actually it's about the kind of equipment and technology and systems that we produce need to be produced with an IT/OT mindset? Or is it still looking at integration, or is it a bit mix of both or something like that?
I think ultimately, and the 5G is a good example, 5G has moved to an IT type infrastructure or architecture. I don't think the OT world can survive without looking at the tools and techniques that are used in IT. That's my own personal opinion. You know, there's challenges out there, absolutely. And maybe some of the points we make, I wouldn't say are controversial, maybe they're a different viewpoint, but you've got to understand why OT grew up the way it did. It grew up the way it is because we remember the Windows systems back in the day used to get the blue screen of death and things like this that made people wary of running their operational technology on Windows platforms because they weren't perceived to be as stable and secure as a PLC, which has a lot of, probably 50 years of history behind it of reliability. So how do you change people's mindsets around that? And there are some companies that run SOC PLCs on PC-based infrastructure, and a lot of PLCs now are, in effect, small little PCs. So what is happening is actually the IT world is is infiltrating the OT world, whether by stealth or by purpose. And some of those things, as we know about, are things like cloud technology, edge technology, IoT, SaaS. So these business models that are driving businesses in different ways will mean, in the end, I believe, that OT technologies will align far, far more around the IT technologies that are available to be deployed in an OT environment. And I've probably said it before, one of my favorite phrases is that what Industry 4 is the adoption of IT or internet technologies, or go further than IT, I'll say internet technologies, into an industrial domain. And that will give us the power, the scale of things like AI
machine learning,
everything that goes with it. And that's all to do with the things that we've talked about before, scalability. If you want scalability, if you want usability, you'll get affordability, you know, and all these other things that we've talked about and some of the things we produced before, Alex, that you can't achieve the scale required without there being some kind of centralization of your definition and being able to distribute that definition throughout your OT world. And we're not talking about scale of one factory, we're talking about scales of hundreds of factories or even hundreds of thousands of businesses on one supply chain system. So the scales that we're talking about are a completely different level to the scales that Industry 3 technologies have ever provided. Then you've got the problem, like we come back to, how do you control the process? Well, the process is key to causing the change to effect. And this is why when we talk about process, what about the introducing of new technology into a facility? Well, there needs to be a process to manage that and put in the checks and balances that aren't necessarily driven by the IT department. They're driven by the Industry 4 convergence manager or whatever that role is. So you need the processes in place, the IT play a part of it to provide the technology stack, but the use cases and the use of those technology has to be driven from the OT world. So that's where I think the IT and OT convergence has to happen, is in the processes of adopting new technologies. It can no longer be good enough that the IT department go, no, we're going to firewall your devices up and we're going to ignore that they live or exist in our facilities. And the OT world have got to accept, they've got to adopt these new technologies as a part of their suite to be able to create scale and business outcomes ultimately for their individuals. So there needs to be this kind of osmotic effect of bringing technology from IT into OT and learning about how to utilize those technologies from OT into IT. Well, so to me, the convergence has to happen in the processes, the structures, and the people within those organizations. The technology is already out there. You know, there's been a lot of innovation money spent on technology, and social media has driven scalability beyond anything we could have ever imagined. It's time to look at those three bases of how do you control the process of adoption of new technology, how do you build structures in your organization so they can be adopted, and how do you train the people in the right way to understand how you can utilize those technologies most efficiently.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. As with a lot of what we talk about, cutting edge technologies, fascinating things, but it comes back to the human element, and you have to change people's minds before you can make use of any of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Change management is the key.
Well, I think we've solved the IT-OT convergence problem there. Just good.
What's next on the list?
We'll do world peace next week, something like that. Alrighty, I think it's time we moved into our interview portion. As mentioned earlier, it's Ella Podmore, McLaren. Should be a fascinating listen. Okay, so for this interview portion of the Atlas podcast, we're joined by Ella Podmore, IET Young Woman Engineer of the Year 2020 and Fault Analysis Engineer at McLaren Automotive. Welcome to the podcast, Ella.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Alex. It's lovely to be here.
Excellent. So if you'd like to perhaps give us a little background on how you got to where you are and the road it's taken.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently at McLaren. I've been at McLaren for automotive, by the way. We're talking the supercar division rather than the Formula One team. And I've been at McLaren for about 4 years now. And my sort of pathway into this whole tech engineering world is that I studied materials engineering. So I had a passion for chemistry when I was at school. I was fortunate enough in the sense that I kind of knew what engineering was from quite a young age. I don't know whether that was like my childhood. My dad was a top tinkerer, and my brothers loved to take things apart, and we were having all sorts being passed around the dinner table. But I kind of knew what an engineer did. They solved problems, they contributed to industry, and from a young age I was like, oh, that's definitely what I want to do. But the interesting part came was like the passion for chemistry. So the scientific element of it, I wanted to be an engineer, but I didn't necessarily wanted to make things like functional or safely, you know, all important stuff. Don't get me wrong. But quite often what the stigma of engineering and how that's stereotyped now is that, you know, you make things safe and structural and
very functional.
Exactly. That's it. Yeah. Functional. And I wanted to do like a little bit more than that. I wanted to make something like crazy, sexy, powerful, whatever it was. And I was sort of exploring like all these different divisions of engineering and fell into materials engineering. And I went to study that for 4 years at Manchester University, got a master's in, an MEng degree there, and managed to get a job at McLaren. And it all kind of started with a placement year. I had the opportunity to do a placement year. And as rogue as this sounds, I genuinely wrote a letter to McLaren, attached my CV, and said, I know you don't employ materials engineers, but I know a little bit about cars. And I think if I could switch a few steels for you and make things cheaper, like this might be a good thing. And I didn't hear back from them for about 5 months. And then they got back to me and said, yeah, OK, let's have an interview, and managed to sort of convince them that I did have a car understanding. So they took a chance with me and pulled me for those 12 months. And during those 12 months, I sort of managed to prove them that actually materials is a good idea. And I took away a thesis topic, came up with a couple of solutions, and then they created materials engineering for me. So I've been back 4 years ever since.
Nice.
Excellent.
You created that's a brilliant role.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? And I love the phrase top tinkering. I mean,
yes.
Engineering, top tinkering.
Top tinkerer.
Yeah. So what was it in your you talked a little bit about your family there. Is it your family into engineering, or was it just home engineering, if you like, in garden sheds and things like this? So,
Yeah, I think it's exactly that, Martin. You put the you hit the nail on the head there. Home engineering. I think we all kind of grew up in quite like an inquisitive household. So my dad and my mum, actually, they both didn't go to university. My dad was sort of like a entrepreneur. He was into printing presses and things like that, and it meant quite a lot of the things he has to take apart. And my brothers are both now engineers, funnily enough, so there's three of us in the family, and they've kind of instilled like this very logical problem solving mentality, I guess. And yeah, it's great. You can imagine the kind of conversations that we have. But interestingly, you know, we talk about, you're all engineers. It's actually very, very different, isn't it? I mean, my brother's automotive engineers, mechanical engineers. I'm a materials engineer, but everything that I do is on a microscope. So it's quite different, quite diverse. But there's got to be some element in the childhood there that kind of steered us all in that direction.
Absolutely. And that, I like that. Is it, how do you classify engineering? Is that kind of desire to solve problems in the mechanical world, but that then breaks down into computer science, material science, system thinking. There's a whole load of attributes are required, but they all have that central thing about seeing how things work and unpicking them a little bit, and then maybe putting them back together again to see if that's better and can you improve it.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the way the world is going at the moment, especially, the lines are blurring as to what we would originally classify a mechanical engineer who went off to work in the automotive industry, or an aerospace engineer who went off to work in the aerospace industry. Now there is so many diverse sectors. I mean, you hit the nail on the head there, Martin, like anyone could be an engineer. I have friends who are textiles engineers that work in the fashion industry, and it's so diverse now. And I think, and I see it at McLaren even now, that we are no longer just sticking to a particular talent pool of engineers. We're employing chemical engineers, software engineers, huge amount of computer scientists. Now all of our cars are becoming computers and things like that. So it's really, really interesting, but I hope we can get across to everyone listening, like, it's not just one particular sector with one particular skill set. It's exciting where tech's going. I think we're going to see more branches of engineering that you and I have never even heard of coming out in university degrees in the next couple of years.
Absolutely. And you talking about your family, as I remember, you know, looking at cars and just standing by the side of my dad whilst he was under a pit, you know, in a pit under the car, looking up at like a Hillman Imp or something like this, or a Maxi, trying to get these things working, where they probably didn't have much electrical systems or even thinking about how a computer was. They were very analog in their approaches. And now everything is, like you said, everything is basically a computer on wheels, really. The amount of technology that's crammed into them. But and let's touch a little bit on your material science stuff. That sounds, chemistry and material science sounds very fascinating. Not an area I've really delved into myself at all, but what was it about chemistry and that material science that intrigued you?
Yeah, I mean, chemistry, I think for me, the thing that got me into that was I loved understanding about atoms and understanding about molecules, how everything is made out of something, right? Like materials make up everything. And I think what really appealed to me about the subject is that I could learn about aluminium. Yes, I've worked for 4 years in a supercar company, but aluminium is going to perform the same way that whether we make a body panel out of it or if we make a bracket on a spacecraft out of it. And I like that translation of tech. And I didn't really want to put all my eggs in one basket. I wanted to see if I could probably go and explore other different industries. But it was the small minuscule element of understanding about how materials work, how atoms interact with each other, how weak intermolecular forces can impact the way that the materials are when we see them in bulk and we see them kilometers along across a river in the form of a bridge, whatever it may be, like the atomic interactions that these tiny, tiny particles do influences that. And that just blows my mind. And I still, you know, still today, most of my work is looking at almost an atomic level. I mean, probably more nanometer scale. But it's kind of at that level where you're going to make the difference. And I think, you know, as Richard Feynman kind of sums it up really well, that like the smaller you go, the more that we can get greater capacity out of something. He talks about it in the concept of computer chips. But I also think about it in terms of where the supercar market's going. So as we look at the automotive industry, we've got two main crucial factors going on. We've got the sustainability element, how we're going to make these cars more sustainable, and then the electrification of these cars as well. If we're trying to make a really light supercar even lighter, the only way that we're going to do this is by looking atomically, going that far down, that far deep. Where can we make the changes? Where can we save the grams and the kilos? So yeah, it was kind of the tiny, tiny element of it and how impactful that can be, but then also how it can be translated across all different types of areas of technology.
And so the electron's your friend, really, then. It's the glue that sticks all your matter together.
Sometimes.
So it's a different form of electricity. So my background's, yeah, electrical engineering. So I was always fascinated by electrons and electron flow. That, you know, what is this thing? And, yeah, I always looked at it from that point of view. And then wondered how it performs in copper cables or aluminium cables, and what's it doing? Where I think you're thinking more of maybe the structural side of material sciences. What are you thinking or visualizing when you're thinking of, you're looking at the nanometer scale, but you're thinking about how that can perform in a larger scale, I'm assuming.
Yeah, but it can, just like you're sort of describing there, it can be, sometimes I do think about the element of conduction, what kind of grounding paths have we got across the vehicle, if we're seeing corrosion, that's the form of a galvanic cell, you know, it completely depends. But I think my work is kind of broken up in the sense that, yes, I do look at surface protection treatments, how do we stop this conduction, how do we stop materials from transferring electrons to each other, but a lot of it is fracture analysis. So we put various development components through their paces on test tracks. We put them in extreme climates, whether it be minus 20 degrees C in Sweden or plus 40 degrees C in the Nevada desert. You know, we've got to make sure that regardless of what we're putting our materials through, our customers are going to get the best performance out of their car, whether they live in Las Vegas or they live in Finland. Like, so it's kind of understanding how the materials fare in those conditions. If they do break, why are they breaking? A lot of the fracture analysis that I do is sort of interpreting like what caused it, and then we capture it in lessons learned and make sure that the future models don't have that kind of experience. And then a little bit is about the personalization as well, so that's where the kind of jazzy stuff comes in, the diamond encrusted badges, the cashmere seats, the fuchsia pink exterior paint, you know, you name it, we've had it. And I think that's a lovely sort of part of my job where I get to sort of make the impossible possible with all of our crazy customers. And let me tell you, money can't buy taste.
It buys you bling, does it?
Yeah, it does.
And so the stress and strains, so how do you, what's the combination of the physical testing you do compared with any computer modeling? Because I guess you talk about corrosion and oxidation and things like that, but what about the physical forces that you're looking at as well? How do you model that and how do you test that out? Because you're looking at something that might last 30, 40 years or something like this. And how do you make sure that those materials will last that long?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we have whole teams built on simulations. And obviously, before it gets to a particular type of development or stage of development along the product development phase, it has gone through various simulation softwares. But we do a lot of mechanical testing. Probably actually not allowed to tell you how much we do.
I was going to say, at what point are we edging in on NDAs and things like that? I don't know.
Martin, and I did respect that. But it's still a combination of both. That's what I will say. You know, we do rely on software to get us to a certain point. But then I think when we talk about we have components on, like most supercar companies do, we have components that have extreme geometries, we have really like bizarre shapes that we're going to need to test, we're going to have to put through rig testing and all the other types of mechanical testing that we do, because there's stuff that you just can't simulate. And I think the way that our components look comes into a big play on that. So it's quite interesting, but yeah, can't tell you all the secrets.
No. But when you talk about the way they look, you talk about the aesthetics of it as well as the form and function, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. But the form will be the main driver as to probably why we've got to do some physical testing over the software simulation.
And that includes, I guess, a bit of additive manufacturing type of work?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we haven't explored that too much because of the numbers that we're doing at the moment. So yes, we have projects that sometimes only do a couple of hundred, but at the moment we're in a phase where we're producing thousands of a high performance hybrid at the moment. So we're kind of, I think we're planning to explore additive manufacturing as those numbers drop, less of a bigger batch. But at the moment, it's sort of all about the hybrid technologies. And that's a much higher mass unit number for us to churn out those AD parts.
Because one of the projects we were involved with, I think it was with Birmingham University, and they were doing atomic scale modelling for additive manufacturing. So they were trying to, yeah, you could program in the different types of materials, and through that kind of additive manufacturing modeling, but they were really getting down, rather than just saying the stress and strains of things, they were trying to see how almost each atom bonded with each atom as you were making it. And it took about 2 days to run the model.
Wow.
but it's almost trying to build it up atom by atom. But once again, this is the difference between those technology readiness levels, isn't it? You have to test some of this out in an R&D way that might not get to your mass production or your thousands of parts, but they're all a part of the knowledge of how we're going to move forward. So you talked a bit about electrification there. How much is that changing your job?
Hugely. I mean, I'll be completely honest, it's like a revolution that the automotive industry is going to go through. It's interesting because we're experiencing, yes, everyone across the world, regardless of what industry you're in, is feeling a sustainability push. But I think the automotive industry in particular, supercars, which is a niche market, mm-hmm. petrol-headed market, they're going to experience sort of strains from electrification, but also autonomous technology. And I get a lot of questions from students and people who are wanting to get into the engineering industry, saying like, I love cars and I would love to work for a company like McLaren who are super performance cars, but where are performance cars going? Are people going to be wanting to buy these cars in 10, 20 years time to race them around the track? Or is it going to be like a completely different way that we view vehicles to getting us from A to B, X, Y, Z and stuff like that? So really interesting discussion. I personally think, I mean, these are my own views. I personally think that it's going to make the supercar industry more interesting. I think it's a new challenge. I don't think petrol heads or motorsport fans and people who enjoy the thrill of driving, that's never going to go away. But I think what we're going to start to see a completely new challenge is where people used to sort of love to hear the roar of an engine, for instance, but now we're going to see incredible acceleration times. I mean, the amount of acceleration that you get from battery technology is absolutely unbelievable. And autonomous technology is quite a funny one as well. Sort of, they sort of say like, oh, well, people are going to stop enjoying driving. They aren't going to be going around the track and stuff. But actually, they forget that autonomous tech isn't necessarily a self-driving car that's going to come over and take over the world and everyone's going to have one. It's actually a combination of technology, sensors and various systems that we can put into a car to make it better. Mm. And the cars that we talk about are very, very powerful. They are, some of them are specifically developed for the track, and it does make driving them to the supermarket, not that many people do, but to the supermarket in motorway traffic or around car parks, it makes that element quite difficult, some of them. And if we were to integrate part of autonomous technology, sensors, self-driving elements that you can take control of the car and make it easier for you, and it can park and it can gauge how far the dihedral doors are going to go up, for instance, I think this is only going to make the customer experience even better. So yes, it's going to change the automotive industry. Yes, we're already experiencing it, but actually we're all quite excited to see where this goes, where the supercar fans are going to take this, and what kind of tech we're going to see on cars. I think it's going to be super, super exciting. And we're already starting to see that with the launch of our high performance hybrid and the mental stats that are coming from that. I mean, goodness me.
I love the passion you have for the motorsport industry as a whole. That's it's great to experience. But yeah,
thank you.
You just think about how, you know, maybe reflecting back in 20, 30 years time, you say it's going to be so radically different. Yet the cars that have been being produced today will be almost be more prestige because they'll be from another era of motorsports, won't they?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be crazy. But it, like I said, it's an excuse for us to push the boundaries. It's an exciting challenge, and we're a company filled with nutters like that. So we're really going to use this this push for autonomy and electrification to see what we can do, push those boundaries.
Exciting times. Yeah, and it's that combination of challenge becoming opportunity. That's where really exciting things happen, I think.
Absolutely. Watch the space.
So yeah, I guess on that note, what's the next exciting thing? I know we just spoke about electrification and automation. Is there anything else that's coming up on the horizon that's really sparking your imagination?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. I think I would have to sort of comment on a pure materials point of view. I think I've touched upon it a little bit. The companies are going to have to start thinking about how to integrate sustainability into their products. And an industry that have had quite elaborate, very expensive cars, we haven't really necessarily had to think about that too much. But it is going to start to get exciting on top of all the revolutionary legislations that we're going to have to satisfy in the supercar industry. We're going to have to start to look towards recycling and the likes of carbon fiber and composite materials like that. Very, very notoriously difficult to come up with a recycle plan. And bioplastics, I think, is a really exciting avenue to explore, and naturally fibered composites and stuff like that. So I'm excited to get the opportunity to start working on this and see what incredible technologies coming out there. I mean, I looked at it quite a few years ago, but the push wasn't there for the demand of these particular types of materials. So I'm really looking forward to sort of looking at more sustainably sourced materials and how we can get them onto our products.
Excellent. We just done a post about that, haven't we, Alex? Green manufacturing.
Fabulous. You're ahead of the curve.
Well, we're only writing about it. We're not doing it. But yeah, it's interesting to see how product lifecycle management moves now into full cycle and where you can reuse in every step in the process, including how do we then dispose of or any of this materials that we produce as well. So really fascinating stuff. More expensive it is, I guess, the more drive there is to it, but there should also be drives about the environmental impact and things like this. But
true,
it's great. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I think we're coming up to time there. Thank you so much for joining us, Ella. I know that we could probably talk another couple of hours on materials and chemistry and lots of other things that went straight over my head, but hopefully into some people's ears. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back another time.
Thank you so much, guys.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Atlas Podcast. Thank you, Martin, and thank you to Ella as well.
Oh, Ella was amazing. Really great. You can see why she, well, to me, is the future of manufacturing. So much enthusiasm, so much vision about how things can be changed. We talked about change management earlier, and maybe that's how change comes. Maybe there's a flow of new ideas and new approaches that needs to come into these organizations before we will really see the impact of the technological change. I would hope it moved faster than that, but I have this kind of concept of legacy of the mind. I feel that's one of the biggest hurdles to overcome with these type of things. I think Ella was a great example of that, wasn't she? Going, McLaren, do you think materials are important? And if she asks enough, then she gets the job. So brilliant stuff.
Absolutely. And it's one of our watchwords or watch terms, embracing bright minds. We're all about that.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, we will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Until then, thanks a lot.
Bye.
For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-atlas.